Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Technology Leaders.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Technology Leaders. Stone, this is quickly becoming one of my favorite shows.
Yeah, me too. I mean, well, I used to take a nap at this hour on Thursdays, yes. But I will say I do enjoy it, and so thankful that the Band of Coders chose to underwrite this show and give us an opportunity to visit with good folks like this. This is going to be a fantastic segment. A little bit later in the program, we're going to get a chance to visit with Rick Copeland. He's co-founder and CTO with Synapio, but first up on Atlanta Technology Leaders today, we have with us the Vice President of Product Marketing for a company called Sales Fusion. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast, Mr. Robert Peace. How you doing, man?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Well, we are delighted to have you. And before this, you were the grand poobah of another company called LoopFuse, if I got that right?
You have indeed.
So tell us a little bit about the progression. What compelled the change to
the evolution from Fuse to Fusion.
Yeah,
it's a common, that take place?
Common theme that's running through these things. So this is pretty fresh news, actually, that Sales Fusion acquired LoopFuse, and that was announced actually last week. So pretty fresh to the whole thing. Both companies were focused on marketing automation as a category, which is email marketing, email lead nurturing, lead scoring, sort of in the broader bucket of marketing technology and enabling online marketing. So it made sense from a lot of levels. There's a great team at Sales Fusion. There's a lot of activity in the marketplace, and this was a great way to get scale pretty fast and apply some of the stuff that we've been working on that was more innovative into a platform like Sales Fusion. So pretty excited.
Now, is this the first time you've been with a company that was acquired?
No, I've been through a couple of these. I've done startups for about 10 plus years or so. Was at a company called Gist, which was actually based out of Seattle, Washington, that was acquired by BlackBerry. The folks from there, which did sort of social contact management, social CRM. So I've kind of been through the life cycle of startups from, you know, seed concept all the way through exit and all the drama, heartache, and awesomeness that goes on in the middle of all that. So
now, can we talk a little bit about this kind of marketing technology space? It seems to be, especially Atlanta now with the, the Salesforce acquisition of ExactTarget / Pardot.
Yeah.
How do you guys play in that?
Yeah, it's interesting that Atlanta's become sort of a hub for this, even in talking to Rick a little bit earlier here and what his business is all about. There's a lot of companies that have started here and grown from here that are focused on things related to email marketing and website optimization, a bunch of other stuff. And I don't know why. I just think it's awesome that it's happening. And there's we're still really in the early innings of this stuff, mostly because the technology is kind of outstripping the abilities of your average marketer. Mm-hmm. There's sort of a digestion issue out there, which is most are still just trying to get their campaigns out and make their website look good and make sure they get reporting. So I think that we're again, still kind of in the early innings of it. I think Pardot did an awesome job, and Silverpop is here in town as well. And there's a handful of other companies, MailChimp, some of these other ones that have done a really great job, both from a building marketing technology, but also building really awesome user experiences and some of these other things. It's just a great place to do this type of thing.
Well, first, let me say I am duly impressed. In my experience, people with the kind of startup resume that you have typically have hair a great deal lighter and a great deal less of it. So one of the things that I would be interested to understand from you, this idea of marketing automation, to what degree does it really automate marketing? Because in some ways it seems like it even piles more work on marketing professionals.
Yeah, I think therein lies the opportunity here. I think that marketing is going through this massive change from the skills that our marketers need to have to how people want to buy and how they consume information, and building enabling technology for that process kind of requires you to map in both those human elements as well as sort of the dynamics of the marketplace. Marketing automation software doesn't like make leads fall from the sky. What it can do,
are you working on that?
Well, I'll get there because what we can do is we make an efficient or make a process much more efficient, right? You can prioritize who you're supposed to reach, when you're supposed to reach them, right term, right time, right person, right place, right? That's standard sales and marketing playbook stuff. But now you can measure it and you can see it, and there's a lot of stuff that happens online about it. And you can extend this even further where, people are, they have their LinkedIn profiles, they have their Twitter profiles, they're essentially broadcasting themselves or advertising themselves, and they're essentially telling people how to reach them and how to sell to them.
Right.
And most companies just completely suck at doing that because there's this mindset of bulk campaigns and lots of other things. So I think there's really a lot of opportunity to get tuned in from a product and a technology standpoint in terms of how people actually want to be sold to. And then you can equip the marketing teams and the sales teams that are out there with products that aren't a pain to use, that don't require additional staff, that are actually, you know, pretty elegant and delightful and addictive to use. Because at the end of the day, it's about driving revenue. And those are all sort of still things I think we're still in the early innings on.
So now is I think one of the tricks to this is that you're a person that has a service or a product that you're trying to sell. Mm-hmm. And you're like, wow, this is perfect. You know, I want to sell some stuff. Isn't the assumption that this company or firm has the ability to send out some type of content / ads, some material that at least piques the interest of the prospective buyer,
mm-hmm.
right? So then once you have that, then your system or systems like it are able to now push this person and nudge them through a funnel and kind of encourage them at the right time to raise their hand and say, I'm ready to buy, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that if you parse this and sort of think about the different dimensions of it, there's sort of a phase of identifying who it is you want to sell to, companies, targets, target accounts, right? All those different types of things. And then there's this sort of middle zone of trying to convert those people into a customer. Not everybody converts in the timeline that you want them to.
Right. you know,
surprising.
Rent has to be paid a certain day, so
every
I better
month.
Sell something.
Right, but that doesn't mean they won't become a customer later because
right.
your timeline is different from theirs. And so getting into this notion of nurturing, right, or revisiting or follow-up, right? I mean, these are offline principles that are just being applied online. I mean, following up on sales leads, believe it or not, works. And
really?
You can actually close business
Wait,
that
that's
way.
Breaking news. Let's pull that sound clip out.
But then there's a whole other dimension to this, which is around retention. And losing those customers that you've worked so hard
right,
to get.
Right, out the back door that you got
That's
them
exactly
in the front
right.
door.
Right. That's exactly right. And so, you know, being, again, if you think about customer acquisition as an online process, or even if you sell products that are mostly offline, you still have a website, right? You still have the ability to do sales inquiries and white paper downloads and whatever. So people are still telling you who they are and that they're interested, and you have the ability to engage with those people over the life cycle. You just got to build in some patience into your process to kind of be on their timeline. And that's one of the big things that's also changing in the marketplace. You know, we're sort of flipping the funnel here. It's not so much about what I want to sell you. It's what about you want to buy from me.
Mm-hmm.
And world-class companies are getting tuned into that to know that I need to be available to you when you're ready to come and buy from me, that you're going to do all your research ahead of it, that, you know, the sales guy's not going to show you stuff that you didn't find online already.
So now, isn't some of the challenges from the customer standpoint, your customer standpoint, is that they sometimes think that the potential buyer isn't that savvy. Like they're not smart enough to know that my product's so awesome, right? And they kind of put it off on their potential customer instead of themselves, that maybe I have to do a better job of engaging with them.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think that lots of sales processes suffer from me wanting to explain to you how my thing works. And what we lose sight of sometimes is the problem you have and the outcome you're seeking, right, from a prospect standpoint. I mean, features and functions and all those different things, attributes, those are important. But I think a mature and an effective sort of sales engagement model really focuses on the outcome the customer is seeking and talks to that. And if you understand their problem and you understand, you know, the pain they're going through on a day-to-day basis, and you can help alleviate that, or even better, make them a hero in their job because you've done it in such an awesome way, really changes the dynamic in terms of how you have a relationship. I mean, we're a software as a service product, and you can come and you can sign up on salesfusion.com and you can get a demo and you can have this very robust product available to you on demand. You can look at your web activity, you can send email campaigns, nurturing, scoring, you can tie all that stuff into your CRM system. But, you know, again, that's attributes and features, right? That's like, what are you trying to do? Wow, we have a problem because we don't know who to follow up with in what order. We can fix it.
But isn't some of the challenges that sometimes you need help like that tool, but sometimes you need a helper to help me use that tool, and sometimes I don't have the bandwidth or I don't have the energy or I don't care
yep.
to be an expert in your tool. You're the expert in your tool. Can't you just make it work for me?
Yep. Yeah, so there's, you know, again, this goes back to kind of the first generation of these things, which are very capabilities rich and very attribute rich. It does a lot of stuff, and you have to have people that know what stuff they want to do. And there's a lot of different ways to do that. SalesFusion has a really good sort of onboarding program and training and constant touch and has the ability
like
to...
Like training with an actual person or like
person,
a video that
nope.
I download? Or
hands-on. hands-on. Because we make that investment on the front end because that way you don't get frustrated and leave us, right? I mean, I think that, you got to look at this. And again, SaaS businesses are interesting animals in terms of their metrics and their mechanics, but you have to look at this notion of a lifetime value of a customer. And I'm not just trying to get every dollar out of you in the first moment. I want to keep you, right? I want to keep you for a long time. And SaaS businesses are all about being in the renewal business. So whether it's a month-to-month contract or an annual contract or whatever it is, I still know there's a point in time where you're going to evaluate whether or not you got the value out of it. And I think that creates, again, this is the shifting dynamic, right? That puts good pressure on a vendor, right, to deliver, as opposed to the original enterprise software models, which were very much about perpetual licenses and maintenance streams and whatever. So I got all your money up front, and I hope you had a good time, right? I mean, so...
well, also, some of these firms, these software as a service, they... You integrate them so much into your life, leaving them is too painful.
Correct. Right. Then you know you've done it right. When you become core to someone's process, and again, a lot of this marketing technology is enabling, and the most successful technology use is driven by strategy and process. It's interesting in the marketing sector because if you think about like accounting, let's say 20 years ago, right, this was all sort of books and journal ledgers and T accounts and all sorts of stuff. Along comes accounting software that automates that, makes it easier to close the books, faster to close the books. You get all this reporting and all this insight.
Right, dashboards, you can see.
Totally,
things,
right? And so many, many years ago, being technical and being a CFO did not go together, right? Now it's absolutely part of the job. And marketing is going to go that direction. You see a lot of stuff about, you know, marketing technologists and chief marketing technologists, but the difference here is that there's no defined underlying process yet. Right. And in an accounting process, you go through the process and you know what accounts payables are, receivables, you close the books, whatever. In marketing, you have the campaign or you have the product launch. And getting into a process-oriented discipline, good companies and world-class companies and progressive thinkers think that way. But a lot of marketing is still very reactive. It's like, oh my gosh, we got to get some sales leads. So let's do a bunch of really bad stuff to go get those leads.
Right. By any means necessary.
Yeah. So that's a little bit of a headwind, I think, in the industry. But I think the tailwind, again, is that there's this ability now to measure marketing, right? And to measure its effectiveness and not have that be trailing, you know, 9 months after you ran a campaign to see it in real time and to do lots of small experiments to see what is tuned. So data-driven marketing is absolutely, regardless of your business, right, is totally something you got to understand, even if it's just going and understanding Google Analytics and understand, you know, put that on your website, see where people are coming from, see the pages they're spending time on, because that's data and that will inform decisions that you can make about your business.
Now, does Sales Fusion have a true sweet spot in terms of a revenue mark for a client organization or certain verticals that really lend themselves to this?
So where we're focused is primarily on the mid-market, which can be defined 200,000 different ways. Generally, our sweet spot of customers is somewhere between the high end, you know, $500, $700 million in revenue, and the low end, lower end, you know, $10 to $15 million in revenue. So some substance in terms of size.
And are they typically users of a different marketing technology product?
They can be. There is, you know, the industry primarily in its first generation was driven by a lot of technology-oriented buyers. Software as a service companies bought this product.
Right, because they were already doing it.
That's right. So there was a little bit of cannibalism that's continued to happen there. You know, there's some pricing pressure and some other things that are kind of going on. But where the growth obviously is, right, is to get out of those and get more vertical. And so we're not totally vertically focused at this stage. There are some things that happen in some companies, like an industrial products company that has, you know, a 6 month sales cycle that leads to a 5 year contracts that are worth millions of dollars is very different than, you know, a software as a service product that has a high velocity model trying to close $9 deals.
Right.
So I think we'll get more mature around that. Our focus again is you know, this is a lot of this is on the go forward basis is to get focused on being much more prescriptive and much more sort of predictive in terms of what you should do and how you should do it. I think there's a real opportunity to bake into products the know-how, right? To know, look, it's not that you can do whatever you want to do. It's that, you know what you should do? You should do a three-step touch follow-up to anybody that ever registers on your website. Right? Mm-hmm. You can disagree with me and tell me it's five. Okay, but I'm going to tell you that best practice is probably say three, but I'm going to give you the option to go to five. As opposed to sort of saying, what do you want to do?
Right.
Right? And that, exactly. that goes back to the absence of process. And so I think we'll bake more of that stuff in, simplify the experience, focus on the core areas that that people get the real value out of. And again, once these things are wired up and in play and you're doing email nurturing, I mean, it works. And the ROI is stunning.
Now, is this in your in your product, is there a kind of a cottage industry of consultants around it that help customers get the most out of it, or is that baked into your product as a whole?
That is, there is. There's an ecosystem that's developed of people that that do this. There's a firm actually based out of here in Atlanta called the Annuitas Group, which does quite a bit of that. There's a lot of other people that have...
So they're like third party. They're not affiliated, but they just kind of like the product. They sell, you know, they encourage people to use the product, and then they're the kind of consultant that helps them maximize.
Right, and we don't have a formal relationship with someone like that, but what they bring to the table is the strategy and the process. And the knowledge of the platform, so they're not going to be like the SIP systems implementation team. They're going to be the okay, great. This is what you want to do. This is how you need to do it. We also have a services team at SalesFusion that can do that for you. I mean, we do some work. I mean, we're a software company and we're a product company, so that's our business. But in some situations, or if we need to do something special for a customer, we'll do that. Again, we also wrap this pretty aggressively around an onboarding process, and you know, you get a dedicated, essentially liaison when you sign up to get you up and running. Because once you sort of get your head around what it is, and you get, you know, a tracking script on your website, which in some cases is a pretty big deal for a marketing person to do, they got to go find the
hey IT guy,
right?
Right, I got this tracking script that you're going to put on every page of this thing.
Precisely, and then that person's like, the last thing I want to do is put something else on the website that's possibly
that the marketing guy told me to do. The guy, you know, in the beanbag chair told me to do this, right?
Exactly. So those are some of the obstacles that are out there. So there's ways to get through that and to create comfort and drive that process. So back to your question in terms of providers, there's everything out there from people who have become, you know, dedicated and absolute, you know, experts on the Eloqua platform. So Eloqua and Marketo very much focused on the higher, bigger enterprise that need that type of engagement. And again, where we are, we want to be available to get our customers set up for success.
Right. You guys want to be that person. Yeah.
But also, we're a software as a service business. Right. And if you're savvy, or if you've seen one of these before, or, you know, you go through our training, which is very regimented, you know, you're ready to go and do what you need to do without the cost of a consultant.
Of getting that consultant.
Right. I mean, that was the you know, back to the ERP days, you'd spend $1 million on SAP or PeopleSoft, and then you'd spend $7 million on implementation. Right. That's just, you know, again, things have changed, and we're not going to have that anymore. So, but there is a role certainly in these types of products for people that are more process or strategy oriented, or even power user types. There's some companies out there that actually do kind of a managed services model around this. It'll sort of be your marketing automation team. So that's kind of this hybrid between agency and product.
Right. Are there users groups that kind of help each other?
There's vendor-sponsored user groups. There's a tremendous amount of them. I mean, if you just go on LinkedIn and search under groups under marketing automation or marketing technology or whatever it is, you're going to find all sorts of people, and you're going to find lots of questions, and you're going to find lots of participation from marketing vendors, technology vendors, because, you know, it's like the most interesting combinations of things, right? It's marketers, marketing technology, right? So the marketing on this stuff has been tremendous. And the early first-generation guys on this whole thing created a lot of market knowledge. Eloqua, you know, basically defined what this is. So now what happens is people come to us and they're like, we want this, as opposed to us having to explain what it is.
Right.
Right. And that's really a nice position to be in, because then we can win. Right, based on our knowledge of what our customers are trying to accomplish, right, the outcomes they're seeking, the capabilities we have, those different types of things.
Your approach to serving the market just strikes me as much more high touch and much more relationship oriented than I anticipated. I guess I thought, because you're a software organization, that would all be kind of arm's length, but I'm hearing undertones here of relationship being very important in a very high-touch ecosystem here. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, I think it's critical. I think in any, I mean, you know, they're in a SaaS business, to be a successful SaaS business, you sort of have to have this concept of a best practices brigade baked into your model, which is, we know the best way to use our product for you to achieve what you want to achieve. If you want us to do that, then we can be hands-on and help you, or if you're good, then we're here to help. I think also what you're seeing is that the emphasis on that now goes back to kind of the overall sort of levels of skills that are out there. As that skill gap narrows, I think there'll be less and less need for it, because, again, it goes back to kind of my accounting example, which is, you know, people understand now when they roll with QuickBooks that they kind of still have questions, but there's an accountant that understands, oh, I got to have this, and I got to have this, and I got to have this. Soon a marketer is going to totally understand, okay, part of my playbook now is I got to have web analytics, I know, I got to have an email nurturing set up, I got to have some lead scoring, I got to, you know, integrate all this into my CRM so my sales team knows who to focus on and when. And then we'll get there, right, because that just builds up, the muscle memory will build up.
Right. Now, what's the pain point that the the company maybe that's a novice to all this is having that this is the answer to?
I think on a couple levels. I think one would be sort of visibility. Like the simplest thing you can get out of one of these products is you put, you know, in our case, you put a script on your website like everybody else does, and all of a sudden you can begin to understand what companies are coming to your website, even if you don't know who it is. I'm just a visiting companies type of view. And then when someone actually takes the stance to say, yeah, I'm interested in telling you who I am, register.
So you're saying that I can see who that company is? I'm not seeing just an IP address?
Yeah, well, so what we'll do is we'll look up to see if we can identify who that IP address is associated with. Some cases it's an ISP, and that's not, you know, going to give you anything actionable. But sometimes, you know, you'll find, especially if you're dealing with larger size companies that have their own networks, that'll surface out that was actually that.
So right there is something valuable because now you know that
Ford Motor Company was on your website.
For some reason.
Right,
you know?
And that in itself is a sales trigger, right? It's like, wow, I've been working a person there. Or
but you don't know who the person Ford is.
Correct.
You just know that somebody in that company hit the website.
Correct, not in that step. And then what you can then do is you can then build out landing pages. And so you do a promo and you do an advertising campaign and you drive people to a certain website and then they tell you who they are. And then, great, now you have leads. And then you hand those to your salesperson. You say, go close this. And again, not everybody's ready to buy when we're ready to sell.
So these are the kind of the baby steps when you're explaining this to somebody that you say, okay, first you're identifying just the random person that hits it. Then now you're doing things that are attracting some sort of an interaction. And I guess that's what you were referring earlier, like white papers or some offer of some kind to capture some personalized data that has a contact or some lead at that point.
Yep. Yeah, sort of going down the continuum here of complexity, right?
Right?
Which is, okay, great. Now you've got a landing page set up and you've got people filling it out. Now you want to follow up, right? Okay, so what's sales follow-up? Okay, what we can do is we can do a message that goes out and amount of time later from us saying, thanks for filling this out, and then maybe we do one 2 days later, and then we do one 10 days later. Content's a big part of this, so you have to understand what you're trying to sell. And what we counsel companies to do is don't get hung up on the technology. The bits and the bytes will work. How do you currently sell? Like, go find your best salesperson and look at how they interact with a prospect. And they'll know. They'll be like, well, what I do is I follow up on day one with this.
Right.
And then 3 days later, I send the customer case study. And then a week later, I send, you know, the third-party article written about how awesome we are. So that's where you go find your nurture flow.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just map that into your product. And then what happens with these is that it just works. It just happens. Nothing falls through the cracks. And so a lead that maybe comes in with a Gmail address – which maybe your salespeople don't think is valuable, but I have a different opinion, which is I think those are very valuable.
Right, because they give you their personal address.
That's their personal address.
Not the company address.
And that's how I try products.
Right.
Right? So, and that's the email address that's going to stay with me.
Right.
So I think those are some interesting things that can kind of bake into this as well, right? But I think that we're already doing a lot of this in an offline way. And that's the gap I think we can fill between this absence of process and presence of it. It's like, go look at how you sell. Right. Go look at the steps that happen when somebody, like your last
like
deal, you
offline,
closed.
And then they communicate it to your the person that onboards or the account rep, and that person says, "Don't worry about the technology. Just tell me what you're doing, and then I'll make the technology work in a parallel way."
Right. Sure. Yeah. The bits and the bytes. My phrase. Right. We'll do in most cases, unless you've got something hyper complex, which I would advise you not to do out of the gate. It's like, great. So now I know every inquiry that comes in. I guess as a business owner, your worst possible nightmare is that you get inquiries and no one follows up.
Right.
For whatever reason. You can do that in a...
Right. Like, you would kill your sales guy if he did that. But you're okay with your website, which is a sales guy, doing the same thing.
Yeah, for sure. Right. Because, again, you're just... Ultimately, this is around customer engagement.
Right.
And everyone deserves... I mean, if someone tells you who they are, they're inviting a conversation. And so not having that conversation is just...
Is rude. Like, you wouldn't want your sales guy to not answer the phone when the customer calls.
For sure. And we'll get into more around email marketing. But, like, if you ever send an email campaign out, especially to a large list, like, watch the responses you get. You're going to get a lot of out-of-office stuff, right? Because that just happens. But every once in a while, somebody will reply. And if you're watching those as they come back in and you engage... Like, believe it or not, and it's a low bar in the world we're in, I guess, that, like, that really differentiates you. But understand what you're doing is you're invading someone's inbox.
Right.
Saying this thing is important to you. And if they are interested enough to reply to you and say, wow, that's cool, or I got a question about this, or whatever it is, and then your ability to come back quickly totally differentiates you.
Now, you had mentioned earlier something about lead scoring or something along that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that, I guess, this would be an example of that. Somebody that responds back would get a high score, like, hey, you better pay attention to me, as opposed to something that's a low score that maybe they are just kicking tires or...
Yep. This is a classic ROI argument. This is the prioritize what I need to spend my time on. Mm-hmm. I got 100 leads. Do I treat all of them equally? Do I alphabetize them and go down the list?
Right.
There's ways to begin to sort of essentially segment those or prioritize those.
Right. You're rank ordering who's the hottest based on kind of
and you
best
can do,
practice.
Do simple things like not only did this person register my website, but they looked at my pricing page and they opened my last 4 email campaigns. Right. So then they're a little more engaged than somebody who's never come to my site.
Right.
Or participated in any way in any kind of email campaign I sent. So it's all about prioritization in that regard. And so if you have, you know, if you have 3 leads a week, this probably isn't for you. But if you have many more than that, or you have a large sales team, or you have, you know, big money you're spending on advertising and marketing to try to drive people into the top of the funnel, you do need to sift out the stuff that's sort of more highly probable to become a customer than not. And one of the things that we're spending a lot of time on, more from a data science standpoint, is the ability to sort of apply predictive analytics around this stuff, which is you look at who's converted as a customer over the past amount of time, and then what you're able to do is you're able to see people tracking to that pattern. And so instead of you having to explicitly say, I want to see anybody that goes to my pricing page, you can say, behaviorally, I want to see people that are tracking in the same pattern as my last customer. And then that helps with the prioritization. And then this also gets at the skill gap that's out there. So instead of us sitting down and saying, I need to assign 5 points to this and 10 points to this and what the threshold is and the range and whatever. You're like, all I want is more like that. Okay, go find me more like that. So there's ability, and I think that's as we look to the next generation of this stuff, to use the data that's available, right, to make informed decisions to around sales actionable information, right? Make it a much more sort of what now type of argument as opposed to the stuff you need to do just to sort of check the task box.
Now, does this work better in kind of a transactional sale or a complex sale, or does it matter?
You know, it can kind of go however you'd like it to, right? I mean, I think that like nurturing is if you have a multi-touch sales cycle, right? We primarily focus on B2B companies, mm-hmm. so there's going to be some.
But like, could I, like a lawyer, a sure. professional service,
sure.
could do this
absolutely
as well as a car dealer?
Yes.
But there would be different techniques, obviously.
Yeah, that was my pause there. I was just sort of thinking through the scenario. But sure, absolutely, right? I mean, you're going to shop online for a car. And there's in the auto industry, there are some particular vertical providers that do it. I don't remember their names off the top of my head. But you're going to engage. You're going to like go to the online configurator and pick your color and your seats and your whatever. And then you're going to inquire to the dealership local to you, and you're going to get an automated email response that it's going to go to Jimmy, who's the online marketing.
Right. In that case, I don't care that much about Jimmy as an individual, right? I care about the car.
Correct.
That's the product I'm buying.
Correct.
But as a lawyer, I care about Jimmy. If Jimmy's the lawyer, I care about to make sure he's the right guy for me.
Absolutely. And that's how that's back to mapping that offline process. How do they sell now? Mm-hmm. You know, we have, you know, consumer-oriented businesses, high velocity, high transaction volume type of companies in our customer mix. And we have, you know, we have one company that, you know, it's a... sort of an industrial manufacturing company. This one has a very long sales cycle, and their nurture flows last.
Like what's very, like 6 months, a year?
Like 4 to 6 months in terms of how they want to get in front of someone, because this is an annual contract process.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to get your business in January, I have to engage with you in
a year,
January.
Right, the year before.
And I want to build credibility, so when it's time and you have to put your contract out for bid, I'm on your list.
Right, at that moment,
in
November.
Yeah. Correct, right. As opposed to sort of saying, wow, I got your name from a third-party list buyer in June, I'm going to send you one email, and the time is wrong.
Right? You missed it.
Right. Yeah, again, it goes back to kind of right person, right time, and then the right message. And there's a lot of art to that. Again, that's the difference here in what marketing is. There's a lot of art that goes into marketing as well as science, and our goal is to provide, you know, the level of science and technology that enables the process and bake in as much of the optimization as we can. To just basically make you a better marketer so that your customers are happier when they engage with you and you get more customers and you make more revenue.
Before we wrap, I want to get your take on why Atlanta has seemed to become such a hotbed for technology and what, if anything, we can be doing to keep it that way.
Mm-hmm. I think there's there's a lot of discussion around this. How do you build a technology center? And a guy named Brad Feld out of Boulder, Colorado, is an awesome guy. He's done a lot around Boulder in that regard. I think Atlanta has a lot of the same componentry that Brad actually wrote a book called Startup Communities. So Georgia Tech's here. Awesome, right? And many years ago, one of the first startups I did in Atlanta was part of the ATDC, which at the time was just sort of some office space on the Tech campus. But that's important, right? Because that provides a place, and it provides no nonsense, and it's nobody trying to get in your pockets. It's like, we want innovation. So having an orientation towards innovation, I think, is important. Atlanta, even over the past 10 years, right, has exploded as a hub of commerce. You are globally connected. I can get on a plane here. I can go pretty much anywhere in the world, right? That's huge. I think that you've got to have an amount of risk capital available, and I think startup communities are driven by sort of their family trees. If you look at Atlanta and, you know, you look at the number of big companies, big tech companies that have started here and grown here, you know, whether you want to call it the first generation was, you know, MSA, which I guess eventually became DMB Software, Harbinger, right? I mean, there's some of these ones that were sort of early technology companies in the sector. But what happens is that breeds people that understand the business. And in good cases, that breeds some wealth, which then can accumulate and be applied as risk capital, angel investing and those things to sort of get ideas off the ground. I think Atlanta needs to continue to focus on that. I think that it has a lot of really smart people here, a lot of people that want to grow this place and are interested in risk capital.
And they're staying here. They might be exiting and they might be being acquired or whatever, but they're also staying here. They're not kind of going.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I'm of the mindset you can build a technology business anywhere. You don't need to be in Silicon Valley. I think you've got to understand the Valley as a dimension of your business and your dependency there. But the best people are everywhere. Right. And so, you know, having a talent hub here is important, but it doesn't mean you don't, you know, can't find somebody that lives in Pittsburgh that's a graduate assistant at Carnegie Mellon that wrote some wicked compiler or something or other. I mean, those are all things that can kind of come to bear. So if you have a community, and the other thing about Atlanta, it's a good place to live.
Right. The quality of life here and it's cost effective.
Right. Right. So I think all those things come in. You got education, you got capital, you got smart people, you've got commerce. It's a diverse city in terms of the fact that from a business standpoint, it's not dominated by one particular industry.
Right.
You know, you've got great companies like Delta here and Georgia Pacific and some of the anchor folks that have been here for forever. But yeah, I mean, even a company like Pardot that started and grew and became this, you know, that's what we need more of. And what's going on over at the Atlanta Tech Village, I think, is awesome because it's a place.
Right.
Right. And
guy who took his, you know, he exited and he invested back into the community. He didn't go off to the Bahamas somewhere.
That's right. And so that's the David Cummings. Those are very important people to have in your community that are oriented that way and that are interested in that and understand the life cycle. Understand there's this stage of a startup, which is around innovation and concept inception and being wrong. Always.
And being okay with it. You have to have a culture that's accepting people that are, you know, make mistakes and used to hire them back and put them somewhere else, right?
That's right. I mean, you know, again, we don't want to fail, but, you know, you have to understand that this is this process of creative destruction, and sometimes you're in the valley of despair, and 12 seconds later, you're in the peak of elation. So I think Atlanta is doing all the right things and has continued to do all the right things, and the companies that are here and that are starting here and the success that's coming from here is indicative of that.
Where can our listeners go to learn more about Sales Fusion?
So go check out salesfusion.com, right? www.salesfusion.com. Or if you're interested in connecting with me, you can email me at robert.pease, P-E-A-S-E, at salesfusion.com.
Well, it has been an absolute delight having you in the studio this afternoon, and I'd love to have you come back sometime, maybe with a delighted client. I'd love to get the client's perspective.
Would love to do that.
Yeah, and so and maybe have it so where they can share, the client can share the pain they were having and then how you guys were able to kind of work. It sounds like you almost partner with them to help them maximize their marketing effort.
Would absolutely love to do that.
You have local clients?
We do indeed. We have lots of customers here in Atlanta, so that would be something we can do.
Fantastic. Hey, listen, you're going to hang out with us for a little bit while we visit with our next guest?
I am indeed.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Technology Leaders this afternoon, we have with us Chief Technology Officer with Synapio. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Rick Copeland. How you doing, man?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So did you learn anything in that last segment?
I certainly did. Yeah. It's it's actually really interesting because my co-founder, when he initially had the idea for Synapio, he believed that, marketing automation is fantastic, but a lot of people are lost. And, you know, what do I automate? How do I get the results that I'm looking for? That was his first idea for Snapio. Now, we pivoted since then, but it's interesting to hear it come back from somebody else. So.
Okay, I got to know the name Snapio. Where'd that come from? Did you make this up? Or?
So the company started at Startup Weekend in 2012. And at that time, it was Synapp. As in, it's a synapse like your brain, and it's the app that helps your brain. So we tried to come up with a better name, and we came up with a much worse name. So we went back to Synapp. And Synapp.com was taken, so we went for Synapp.io, and Synapio was born there. So
so now you guys kind of evolved from a incubator-y kind of beginnings too, right?
Yes, we did. So we started out at Startup Weekend, and then it was probably 2 months after that we actually founded the company, and maybe 2 months after that we joined Flashpoint at Georgia Tech.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been that was fantastic in helping us to discover that what we thought was a market was an idea, and help us to actually find a real market.
Can you share a little bit about that distinction, because that's really important?
Sure. So we came in, and the pitch was, we want to help small and medium businesses use big data insights to derive action, or big data optimizations to derive actionable insights. So it sounds great. And a lot of small and medium businesses might be like, oh, yeah, that'd be great for free. But, you know, it's a nice to have. It's not a have to have. And so, you know, market and something that's legitimate is something where there's actually cash flow going. You know, people are spending money on something. So what we found out, we found something that people had to have. And that's how we pivoted into the space that we're in right now.
And the problem that you're solving, the pain point that these folks have?
Yeah, so the problem that we discovered was, in talking to, you know, over 200 email marketers, was almost everyone ends up getting suspended or fired by their email service provider at one time or another. MailChimp, for example, will suspend about 400 accounts a day for falling out of compliance with their practices. That could be too high of a bounce rate, or, you know, maybe they've bought a list and put it up on MailChimp. So what we do is we meet the customer at that moment of pain when they have to get out a marketing campaign, and we come in and we say, well, we can fix your list, bring it back into compliance, and we can do it very quickly through software as a service application. So they, you know, get them at a moment when they're about to lose a limb, not when they have a headache, you know, that's the kind of thing.
There's more of a sense of urgency at that point.
Definitely more of a sense of urgency. And, you know, we haven't abandoned the idea that we can somehow help them optimize their marketing efforts down the road, but we feel like this is the way to get access to those customers.
What a nice point of entry. What was it like trying to get this thing off the ground with your own money, probably very little money? You didn't start with a lot of capital, is it? Yeah?
No, we were pretty much bootstrapped at the beginning. So Flashpoint gave us a little bit of seed money as a convertible note through the Flashpoint Fund. And then it was a lot of credit card for me. My co-founder has had some successful exits, so he was doing all right. But then I guess it was we founded in January, and we started getting revenue in April. And this January, we passed $1 million run rate. So that was pretty exciting.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And it grew from the two of us to 10 people by now. And I think our first two hires were September 1st. So,
now, was this your first startup?
So I've been an employee at a startup before, but I've never been a founder or, you know, a really early employee. I was an engineer at ProSolaire, which was a startup founded by a couple of professors out of Georgia Tech. It went okay until capital dried up. They had the classic mistake of mistaking revenue for capital. So, you know, it's like, oh, it's, you know, how are the books looking? Oh, it's great. We should close another round next week, you know.
So in bringing on people, I've always wondered this, because we have had an opportunity to do remote broadcast at startup events, and the people that we have an opportunity to interview, they're just so passionate and they're fired up, and you can tell that they just really throw themselves into this work. My question, I know it's Lee's too, where do you find these people? Because I want to go hire them and put them to work in my operation. So finding and building a team like that, speak to that a little bit.
Well, so that is probably our biggest challenge right now, is finding the right talent. So far we've been able to do it basically on our personal networks, myself and my co-founder. So he knows the marketing side of the business and I know the technology, so I can bring in people from in the local Python community or local MongoDB experts, things like that.
Because you're integrated in that, you're a member of groups and online communities.
Yeah, exactly. So I've been a member of the Python Atlanta user group for probably 10 years. And
so you can tell who knows what they're doing, maybe who doesn't as much.
Yeah, yeah. So that definitely helps a lot. And
but there's the guy that knows what he's doing and the guy that's willing to risk a little bit of sweat and time and energy to go hang out with you instead of Coca-Cola or whatever, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
You got to get the guy that meets both of those.
Well, and one of the things that I've found in my life as a technologist is the kind of people that we want in our startup are not necessarily the people who are going to be solely motivated by money. You know, maybe they could make more at Coke or Home Depot or something like that. But what really kills motivation in a software engineer or really in, I consider myself kind of a geek. So what will kill your geek's motivation is ignoring his work and making his work irrelevant. So, or her work irrelevant. So it's a sense of significance. Like I'm moving the company forward. I get to have some visibility into, you know, why am I doing what I'm doing? One of the worst things that I heard is a previous company that I was at, my boss was in a meeting with the head of marketing and, or maybe it was sales. I don't know. I kind of blocked it out, but he basically told him, you just need to do what you're told, when he was asking him for the reasons why, you know, we needed to do a certain technology, implementation. And, you know, that doesn't end up letting you attract and retain the best technical talent.
Because that person's right there. They're checked out now, right? They're looking for other
exactly.
opportunities.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not being appreciated, and this is not any more a good fit.
Right. And we try to be exactly the opposite of that at Synapio. So we sometimes we use the term deliberately developmental organization. So that's something that we picked up at Flashpoint. The idea that everybody's there to grow. We're not just picking people up for their existing skills. We're mm-hmm. picking them up for, you know, we want them to be able to contribute off the bat, but we also pick them up for their potential. And specifically, we want people who can come in and question us, because we know that we're not right most of the time, even. You know, I don't think anybody's right most of the time.
Sound like you.
Yeah.
So now, what's it like going from that role of I'm doing all the work and I'm the guy that's the technology guy to now I'm managing other technology people? Was that a difficult pivot for you personally?
Yeah, it still is a difficult pivot for me. So we're still in transition. So like I said, we hired our first technical hire was September 1st. And someone that I'd worked with at a couple of different jobs before. So already knew that I worked well with her. I was comfortable hiring remotely in that case. And then, you know, starting to hire people locally that you know a little bit less well, that's been challenging. So we've got some processes in place. We are a very agile development organization. So we have daily stand-up meetings where everybody, you know, maybe for 5 minutes, you touch base and you see, you know, what did you do yesterday? What are you doing today? What's
stand-up
blocking you?
Stand-up meetings. I like that.
So literally you stand up?
You stand up?
Well, or just call that?
That's the idea.
That's the idea, right?
Yeah, because people will be tended. If you're sitting down at a conference table, you'll be there for half an hour. So we've been doing that, and we also have weekly iteration planning meetings where we try to make sure that people know what they're working on. They have bite-sized chunks of work to work on. We can prioritize things along those lines. So being able to get that process in place and work with the people as you know, as we're growing the team has been very helpful. I am finding that you know, recruiting is always a challenge, just because you spend half your time doing it.
It's time consuming, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And you know, sit down for an interview, and maybe you've got interviews. You get two interviews on the day, and then you get 2 hours between them, and so your day is just shot at that point. So,
right, and I'm sure from your standpoint, it's hard to get in and out of the mindset of the technology part, right? Like that's something you sit down and you do. It's not in little bite-sized chunks.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been, you know, I think anybody who's been programming for a long time has this feeling that, you know, it's my baby. I want to keep it, and I want to be the one who's the major contributor. And being able to try to step back from that is important, although it's hard, and to be able to say, you know, well, I can't fix this problem, not because I can't fix it, but because I don't have time to fix it. So, you know,
right.
You go and work on that for a while, and then trusting your team to be able to execute on that.
And so in growing the organization and scaling, is there some magic formula that you know when to put a little more money, time, energy, resources, and grow the company a little bit in relation to the revenue or the amount of business you've got? Because even in our operation, as we continue to grow, you know, we're always concerned, are we growing too fast? Should we move faster and do more or bigger? How do you guys attack that?
Well, so one problem that we ran into actually last November was we found that we actually found a pain point in the market that was so much that it was scaling faster than we could meet the demand. So yeah. We had a technical scaling problem. And that was just kind of a hair on fire moment. And we start trying to build everything and build the technology to scale where we thought it would scale before. But so all that to say that, you know, we up till now, we've been pretty reactive because, like I said, we started out with a very small amount of seed capital. We've had a couple of angel investors which have helped us along.
Right.
But we're mostly bootstrapped, you know, mostly revenue, mostly organic growth up to this point. So we've had to kind of hire behind the revenue curve, which puts us in a little bit of a tough position. We're hoping to kind of start being able to run at a loss for a little while, hire ahead of demand, because I think we're confident enough of the direction that the market's going, the direction that our growth is going, that we can do that without always freaking out about running out of cash in the bank account, not being able to meet payroll. So
what counsel, if any, do you have in courting or responding to angel investors? And actually, Robert, in a minute, I'd like for you to weigh in on some of this too, because you've lived through this as well. But if you would share something from your experience in working with angel investors.
Well, so the two angels that we have right now have been both personally introduced to us through the Flashpoint program. So that's been fantastic.
Nice. Well, these Flashpoint folks,
yeah,
that seems to be a good group of folks to know, doesn't it?
It absolutely is. And I think being involved in an incubator is huge because of, I mean, there's certainly the curriculum that you learn and, you know, the activities if you have to go out and talk to 200 customers. But I think also just the mentor network. You're up there, you're in front of people, even if you're completely passive. There's a whole lot of people with checkbooks who have seen you present every week for the last, you know, 8 weeks.
And you're still there, and you're still doing something.
So and you're still there, yeah.
And you're going, hey, maybe I'll throw some money for these guys, right?
Right, and you do have to, I think you do have to be a little bit selective. There are some people who will just come in and, you know, they want to write a check for, you know, 5% of your company, and they want, you know, 40% control and preferences on any buyout, and, you know, and maybe they want to, you know, they want a stipend as well to be your investor. You gotta watch out for that. But
do they help you at Flashpoint, like, kind of manage that?
Yeah. So the access to the mentors. So the mentors are all volunteers at Flashpoint, and that's certainly helpful. It's people who just want to contribute back and maybe pick up a couple of deals along the way. But you know, we sat down the first term sheet that we received. We sat down with Merrick First, who's the founder of Flashpoint and one of the mentors, and we just went through it line by line. And he was, you know, they deconstructed and said, you know, this is good, this is not good, these are the things that you should go back and talk to them about.
Nice. Anything to add to that, Robert?
No, I think that's a great sort of perspective on it. I guess the thing about raising money is that when you're starting, you become obsessed about it because that's what you have to do to
right.
get going. But raising capital is really just the end of the beginning. and the stakes get much, and the stakes gets much, much higher. And so I think that, as you've just sort of alluded to, like, look beyond the money. The money certainly is important because it helps go. But this is someone who's going to be part of your company. And yeah. not only part of your company, but from a governance standpoint, kind of your boss, depending on how it's structured. So, you know, keep that in mind, and I think you can be very proactive about who you want to do business with. And if you've got a great company and you've got great people and you're smart and you've got good traction, you know, map that to the right type of investor, and you can have a really productive conversation. Map that to the wrong type of investor. Maybe they do later stage deals. Maybe they don't care about your industry. Then you're wasting everybody's time. And it strikes me how often that happens, that people just literally try to everybody and anybody who possibly has any way, shape or form the ability to fund their company. And it's just sort of it's not a very elegant way to go after it versus saying, hey, you know, I want a meeting with you, 20 minutes of your time. You know, I've done my research. You've invested in this space before. You know it. You know the players or whatever. Or don't go pitch someone that invested in a competitor. I mean, that's wasting everybody's time. So
right.
I guess that's a
right.
A,
and it's not money isn't really the objective all the time. I mean, money seems like that might solve a short-term problem, but you're really looking for somebody that has access to a partnership that might be able to give you distribution.
Yeah, I mean,
or
look,
you know,
the mentoring aspect is important. The network related to hiring is important. The been there, done that related to good things or bad things is important, because there's going to be both. You know, again, if something isn't going wrong by 3 o'clock every day, you should wonder what's going to happen.
Tomorrow's going to be a double.
And just look
day,
forward
right?
to it, and know it's not the end of the world. But sometimes
right.
that's a lonely path, right? Especially as a founder or a CEO, where, you know, you're not sure if you're making all the right decisions, and it's important to have somebody. Whether that's an investor or that's just a member of your board,
right?
That's, you know, not in the weeds with you every day, that can just provide some perspective. I think
what about a board
thing.
Of advisors? You find that?
I do, but you have to task them. You can't just have, hey, I'm going to put you on my board of advisors.
Right.
It's like, yay, I'm on this company's board of advisors. I mean, it's like, what's the ask? Why do you have a board of advisors? Go out and get someone that knows about user experience. Go out and get someone that knows about scaling architecture. Go out and get, I mean, basically be informed around it. And there's so many people that are so generous with their time. that don't pay people, right? If you're going to really task somebody up, then you should pay them. But if it's just a matter of I just need
like
your counsel.
Check in for a phone call periodically.
I see a lot of really crappy proposals from people that claim to be mentors that want a piece of the action.
You got to watch that, right?
Yeah, and I just think that's there's a time and a place for that because if you are that valuable, right, you'll be rewarded. But I think leading with, hey, here's my stipend, is that what you referred to? Come on.
That's a red flag.
Right? Come on. Right, call me, and I don't know that I'm going to be right, but I'll certainly give you some perspective, right. And I won't charge you for it.
There's no stipend for answering a question.
Right. So what roles are you filling, Rick? Are you out hiring now or will be in the near future?
Yeah, we are actively looking to grow our technical team primarily. So we're looking for senior and junior developers, both, although I think probably our biggest need is for senior. At the moment, we have a couple of junior guys who started with us fairly recently, and they're working out great, but you still need somebody who can kind of take something and run with it and lead the overall architecture and direction. So.
Well, what can we do to help? What do you need more of? You need more customers? You still need some more money? What can we do to help?
Well, so our customers are coming in pretty regularly, so we're pretty happy about that. I think just the awareness of, this, if you get into trouble with your email service provider, you get blocked by MailChimp. I think MailChimp's doing a good job of sending people to us, but
nice.
If you don't get that referral, we'd love you to come by. You don't have to be a MailChimp customer, but we do work closely with
right,
them.
Right. Like, so the other, like Constant Contact or any of the other email companies would be people that give you leads or could give you opportunities?
Yeah, we've been talking with Constant Contact and Pardot and, the other companies in the ESP space and marketing automation as well. So certainly looking forward to, getting to know Sales Fusion a little bit better.
So I was going to say, and us, we're going to have a conversation.
Yeah. Yep.
Fantastic.
Talk now, about serendipity.
Isn't
huh?
that great? I told you we should start instituting
You're welcome,
a cover
Rick.
Charge for Yeah, we should get a stipend.
Really? A stipend.
A stipend. Yeah, there you go.
I can get on that train.
So I don't know how you missed this in your pre-show research, Lee, but these guys at Snapio, they were named the unsexiest startup by 500 startups at their unsexy conference.
Is that good?
What was that?
Is that something we're proud of?
Well, so it's a little funny thing, but it is something that we're proud of, definitely. So so Dave McClure at 500 Startups decided that he was going to have a conference about all the unsexy aspects of running a startup and also have a pitch contest at the end for the unsexiest startup. So he had a little little Jeff Foxworthy, you might be an unsexy startup if. And it had all these lists of things. You're not social. You dream about being acquired by LinkedIn or Salesforce, not Twitter. Your customers don't talk about using, or they talk about someday using the Twitter. That kind of thing. But the idea is, it's companies that maybe they're not going to land on TechCrunch because they're not the newest hyper local co-sharing whatever thing, but they're making money. So it's the companies that maybe they actually have some revenues. And that was where we were at the time. And, I guess the other two startups were just too sexy for the conference. And so we got that. And then 500 Startups put in a bit of money as a convertible note. So, yeah, that was pretty big for us.
There were high-fiving going on when you got that news?
Yeah, lots of high-fiving. And everybody at Flashpoint was excited to hear about it because there's a little national recognition for the Flashpoint program. So
that's right. Great.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on that. Keep up the good work. Please do continue to let us know anything we can do to help you get the word out about what you're doing for the market, the community, the profession. I'm just thrilled to death for you and excited to see how this thing unfolds, man.
Well, thanks a lot, and thanks so much for having me here.
And yes, the website one more time?
Synapio, synapp.io. And if you just need to get an email list clean, you can go to datavalidation.com. That's our product.
And that's a way to try it, or there's a fee for that?
So you can actually get a free report on the quality of your list just by uploading it. And you do not need to purchase anything for that. If you decide, once you've seen how bad your list is, that you really do need to get the undeliverable addresses removed.
Let me guess, are most of the results that you need to improve your list?
Well, I mean, we give you the same results. But it turns out most people could use a little help.
I know, because that's the problem to solve, not that I'm not
right.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for being part of this today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next week on
Atlanta Technology Leaders.
Atlanta Technology Leaders is brought to you by Band of Coders. Band of Coders is a company of talented software developers who energize clients' projects and their development teams.